years, I would be be in charge of bringing indictments, presenting cases for indictments to the grand jury.
Mm-hmm. What kind of cases would you be interested in?
Well, cases of a political nature where there could arguably be a conflict of interest with the DA's office or between political groupings. It's hard to say exactly, hard to predict what kinds of things will come up.
What I'm saying is that the citizenry, the grand jury is theoretically, I don't think it actually is in actuality, because it's often led by the district attorney, the forum or the process through which the citizens can actually deal with the abuses in different aspects of our political, local political system. What are those abuses, and how would you use the grand jury to deal with them, or how would you yourself directly deal with them?
Well, there's a bifurcation now in grand jury. There's the civil grand jury, which the DA is not concerned with.
There's
the criminal.
Gotcha, I'm a little confused there. Go ahead.
Yeah. The civil would be dealing with things like what's going on in the sewage inspection program for the county, septic inspections. Apparently there's a big hoo-ha there about, a lot of abuse.
How about the guardian's office and the way people who are deprived of their rights through psychiatric processes go?
There again, that's a civil
matter
as opposed to criminal.
Not something you'd be involved with.
Right.
So you would, however, have a great deal to do with 30-40%, I guess. Are you saying that 30-40% of the space in our local jails is taken up with essentially victimless drug crime, or is there more?
Yeah, at least that, probably more, mm-hmm. actually. Young Latinos from Watsonville and the Beach Flats area, for example, fill up a huge percentage of our jails. Minor drug offenses, but this is a way to control these dangerous minorities, according to the prevailing view in the police circles.
Mm-hmm. Well, wouldn't this, taking a page from former Mayor Mike Rotkin's book, wouldn't this result in a magnet effect where all the junkies and drug dealers would come to town because they would hear you're so soft on drugs?
No, I don't think so. I mean, studies have been done, like in Oregon in the 70s when decriminalization went into effect, there was no increase in usage in the whole state of Oregon. I think that's just a red herring that they try to trot out every time you want to try to change the laws for the good.
What about stories in Switzerland and Amsterdam of decriminalization of heroin, or England? Would you also favor decriminalizing those drugs?
Oh yeah, I mean, remember this good doctor on the ABC radio? What's his name? Deany Dell, Dr.
Mm-hmm.
Deany Dell. I heard him one day. He was talking about comparing heroin to tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
Someone asked him, if your son was to take up one of these two drugs, which would you prefer that he take up?
Mm-hmm.
And without hesitation, he said, oh, absolutely no doubt in my mind, I much prefer that he use heroin than tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
Tobacco's going to kill him. Heroin, if it's used in the proper dosage, et cetera, you can function just fine. And in fact, the founders of Johns Hopkins Medical School, one of the foremost medical schools, the very founders of that medical school were lifelong heroin users.
So
every night they'd go home and snort their stuff, and then they function perfectly during the day.
So your program for getting people off of tobacco is through, say, a massive heroin re-education program?
I don't think so. Kind of like a methadone.
What about methadone? What's your sense about that kind of...
Well, it's kind of a palliative. I don't see it as a long-term...
Some claim it's an instrument of state control.
Yeah, in many ways it is.
Mm-hmm.
Many people are forced onto this kind of a program when it doesn't really do the same thing for them, and they just go right... When the others is available, they just go right back to it.
How can people make it more likely that you will be chosen to be district attorney on, I guess, next Thursday? Is that when it happens?
Yeah. Well, I'd say call Jan Butte. Almquist.
Do you have those phone numbers?
454-2200.
454-2200 if you want Ed Fry, who we are talking to. Ed Fry, local criminal defense attorney, running for district attorney, hoping to be appointed the only candidate to favor both ending the death penalty and ending the drug war, which is actually the war on people. Would you like to make any comments about those who are running if, let's say, they decide you are too far out there? I think that they are too far out there, frankly. let's say, what do you think of Christine McGuire? I'm looking at the names in the paper here. Any comments on, you want to go through talking about the candidates?
She's the one I would pick last. I wouldn't pick her at all, ever, because of some serious problems that she had a few years back. She committed an act of extreme indiscretion and had a serious violent conviction overturned as a result. She was sleeping with the defending attorney in the same trial.
Are you talking about Tom Kelly?
No.
That's another matter.
This is up in Tehama County before she came here.
Okay.
She, in People versus Jackson, it's a reported case. It was, I think it was a violent robbery conviction. And she was actually sleeping with the public defender who was defending Jackson.
She's just trying
to get... she was prosecuting him.
Well, they were trying to get together, you know.
Well,
what about John Hopkins?
I don't have a whole lot of respect for John Hopkins because for 20 years he was the right-hand man to Art Danner, and that should say enough right there.
Peter Chang.
Peter's a great guy. I think he'd, you know, do a good job if his health held up. I mean, he's pretty getting on in years, you know, and he's had some problems, but. He's much better at the job. He would be much better at the job than anybody in the DA's office that I can think of.
Bob Lee?
I don't think Bob Lee has the maturity for the job. Bob's a pretty emotional guy, and I think that he doesn't have enough balance, emotional balance on it. He just gets carried away with things.
Ariadne Simons?
Well, I don't know her enough. She's fairly new to the DA's office. I haven't any cases against her. I like what I see, so I have nothing negative about her.
Ron Ruiz?
I don't know about Ron. I think he's a pretty good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. This first time I've met him or heard of him, you know, he's been always a Santa Clara County guy,
mm-hmm.
even though he lives over here.
What about your favorite person, Kate Canlis?
Well, again,
I was kidding.
Danner ally, and I think she's. I don't think she's takes a humane enough view toward things. I mean, the DA's job is not just get convictions; it's to do justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Kate sees things that way. I think her goal is she's like a real lifelong prosecutor whose number one goal is to convict everybody. And I don't think that's the right approach. The DA's office is the most powerful job in our society. It really is, because you can make or break a person's, mm-hmm. you know, freedom or fortune or life itself, you know, just by the stroke of a pen. And you got to make sure you've got somebody in charge who's going to take a broad view and go for what is really right, not just go for convicting people and putting them behind bars.
Any other specific parts of your platform you'd want the public to know about?
Well, I think the most important factor in the DA's race is that it is a political race because you're chosen by the people generally. So you need a leader. You need someone who's going to take charge and make decisions that are difficult to make.
Mm-hmm.
None of these other eight people took on Art Danner when he needed to be taken on because he was corrupt,
mm-hmm.
he was unprofessional. He did a disservice to this county in many, many, many ways, and one of the, not the least of which, was to overcharge the death penalty in so many cases that it, you know, it was gross,
mm-hmm.
and he lost a lot of them, and he cost the taxpayers of this county, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars each time he did that. And then he was corrupt in so many other ways. I ended up suing him for that Catherine Gardner thing, for example, after it became public. So I'm the only one, the thing to remember here, you want a leader, and I'm the only one who chose to go after him when he should have been going at him and challenge him, you know,
mm-hmm.
try to bring out as much as I could find out about the guy.
They couldn't shut you up, Ed.
Yeah.
Again, the number to call to persuade the unpersuadable, the Board of Supervisors, is 454-2200. Is that correct?
That's correct.
454-2200. If you want to help, Ed, are you going to be running for DA again? Do you know?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. You're running now. I can see that.
That's right.
The other thing I guess I wanted to talk to you about before you leave, we're talking to attorney DA, and hopefully future DA Ed Fry here on the phone, is the issue which has been near and dear to many of our hearts, changing the law that makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep outside in Santa Cruz, so that there would be specific legal sleeping areas for people to sleep in. And the most recent pronouncements of the mayor, I don't know if you've been faxed the copy of the law and the relevant stuff. Did you get that stuff yet? Or
yeah, I got it.
Have you looked it over?
Briefly, just now.
Well, you know what I think I'm going to do? I'm going to give you a little more time to look it over. And maybe I can call you in about half an hour.
Well, I did review the ICORN decision.
Ah, yes. The ICORN decision, of course, is the decision that makes it a real possibility for a person who is sleeping outside and then is arrested by an officer for violating the city's sleeping ban to say, look, I had to do so as a matter of necessity, right?
Right. The defense of necessity, common law defense.
To avoid a greater evil.
That's right.
And you think that is a... What's your reading on this ICORN ruling?
Well, it's a good ruling. I think it's for the first time it's established law now that a homeless person who's trying to sleep can raise the defense of necessity if he or she is arrested. The necessity defense meaning that you are only doing it in order to avoid a greater evil. Balancing test going on. Is it more evil to allow a person to sleep in a public place or to disallow that person and deprive that person of sleep?
Mm-hmm.
And pretty clearly, the more evil thing is the deprivation of sleep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is a very important ruling. It's interesting the process as to how that ruling was accomplished. You know, the law firm that brought that on behalf of ICORN is the premier law firm in Southern California, O'Melveny & Myers. So that's how things get done. You know, when you got real juice in front of them, that's when you get results in the Court of Appeals.
I better call them up here immediately.
That's right.
Well, you know, I know that tomorrow there is another meeting, perhaps the final meeting of the task force to examine the camping ordinance, or the task force, as they call themselves. They'll be meeting at 4 o'clock on the second floor of the library. And I know that 15 minutes before that meeting, there apparently the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban, Santa Cruz Action Network, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, perhaps the Community Action Board, Peace and Freedom Party, the Green Party, and various other groups are going to have a press conference to demand that the elected candidates, Crone and Sugar particularly, who are members of this task force, stand up for and support the right of homeless people to sleep and the promises they made to the public during their election. And after this is with the hope of getting Catherine Byers to take a more sensible and humane position on the issue than she has so far, the theory being that she will be led eventually by those who are newly elected with a 64% landslide if they have the courage to speak out publicly. And we're going to encourage them to speak out publicly. And then at 5:15, after this hour meeting upstairs in the library, on the second floor of the library, to which all listeners are invited, we're going to have some attorneys speaking about the implications of such things as the ICORN decision and plans to file our own lawsuits and to protect homeless people locally, particularly in light of, as I've been talking about, these 9 or 10 assaults that have happened within the last 2 or 3 weeks, where homeless people have been hit by 2 or 4s, kicked in the face, had their ribs fractured, elderly women and drunk men, 3 put in the hospital, in a situation where homeless people are completely unsafe. And I guess a number of attorneys, we were hoping to have you attend as well. Do you think you're going to be at that 5:15 meeting?
Yes, I do.
So I want to invite our listeners to come on down to the steps of the library. Bring your umbrellas if it's the same day as it is today. Hopefully it'll be a little clearer up there. But and to really put some heat on the elected representatives. And I think that if a lot of attorneys get together to share the burden, in the past it's always been one or two people, and you can't expect people to carry that kind of burden. And I know you're a busy person, you have a large family to take care of, you know, you're in the middle of another kind of struggle with the district attorney's office that really, I guess, is kind of unending. But hopefully it'll be a flash of lightning on Thursday and all will be resolved.
There's hoping.
Anything you want to say additionally about either of these subjects, the DA's race or the sleeping ban?
No, I think we've covered it.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time this afternoon, and I guess I'll see you tomorrow at 5:15. If not before, you're invited, of course, to come to the meeting and observe this process in action.
Right. Okay, Robert. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I need a home, but my boots keep pulling. Healing and peace that a fire could provide, a place to unburden the brain of its sorrow. First things first when you get to the fire. A word to the wise that the earth must provide, a tune to untangle the riddle of growing.
And we're on the air with Dan Hopkins. Before we go on, a caller just called in asking about the some of the allegations around Officer, now Sergeant Baker, and we around the Valenzuela and Sweeney cases, which I do not have the details on, but I'm hoping to get from John Malkin and others connected with the Coalition for Citizens Police Review Board. And also, we are limited in time. I told the previous caller, we're letting you in briefly here, Dan, but we're going to rush right into this task force hearing from last Monday to hear what actually happened. You get to hear the grim realities as we hear Catherine Byers selling out. But what do you got to tell us?
Oh, I just wanted to call in, you know, so that your listeners can make just be a little bit more aware, you know, about what's happening with homeless people, you know.
Mm-hmm. And, I know there's been a lot of violent assaults lately, right?
Right. And aside from that, you know, that's the most serious of all, probably. But, for instance, right now, at this moment, it's, you know, it's pouring down rain. Last night was even worse, you know. And the elements by themselves is enough for the homeless to have to put up with, you know, waking up with all your stuff wet, maybe yourself even wet, your sleeping bag, whatever, you know. And if there was more services or some place where people could, you know, could more in designated areas sleep with cover, you know, like even a Quonset hut or these metal storage sheds, they make perfect places for two people to sleep, you know, one or two people to sleep, and they're very inexpensive. But the main thing is that I wanted to bring out is that the homeless people on a daily basis, because I'm a homeless person, you know, and I've been for 17 years off and on, and I know that they live in fear when I open all night long, you know, and that's why a lot of them get drunk, is because it's just too much to face, you know, worrying about the cops, the troll busters, and in some cases even animals out there in certain forested areas, you know, where they know they go far and far into the woods because of the laws and getting a ticket for $162, going to jail because they don't have the money to pay for no $162, you know. And then they have to pay, I think it's $50 just to do the community service if they're lucky
right.
enough to get community service, you know. And they don't even have the $50 to do that, so they have to stay in jail.
Well, Dan, are you going to be at this press conference, the two press conferences on Monday at 3:45 and then again at 5:15 at the front of the library?
Yeah, I won't be able to get there till around 4, though, because I don't get off work till 3:45.
Well, of course, everyone's invited to come and also to sit in on this task force meeting from 4 to 5.
Uh-huh.
And it's also, by the way, a meeting of students for Students Against the Sleeping Ban happening up on campus at
uh-huh.
the same time.
Uh-huh.
There's everything seems to be happening at the same time on Monday. But if anybody's interested in helping out with this issue, do give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Anything else that you could tell me, Dan, before I rush you off here?
I was just... remembering over the past years, you know, since we've been trying to do something about this camping ban and having places for people to sleep, is a couple years ago we did, actually you and Becky, I think, did a three-day analysis about how many people had died, and we counted 11 that had died in, you know, hypothermia, got caught under a bridge where the grate held them down, and they died of hypothermia there, and then one guy got stabbed in the head, and a lot of these people were known people to go to the the shelters and stuff in that tent city that we used to have.
Coral
and,
Street.
And it was at this time of the year when most of the people died between now and, let's say, about a month after March, you know, into April.
They closed the Coral Street shelter in December of 1995, and I think there were, I don't recall any deaths at the shelter, but I think that you pointed out afterward there were many deaths, right?
Yeah, no, there was 11 deaths that we attributed to be along the river, people who died under different circumstances.
This was after the shelter closed, right?
After the shelter closed.
After the tent city
and
closed.
And there was no armory open at that point either.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when most of the people died. And we only got 11, and there's a we're sure that there was a lot more than that, maybe 3-4 times that much, you know? But we can't trace them all because we didn't watch the newspapers close enough. And maybe they don't even list sometimes when it's a transit or unidentified person, you know?
Well, Dan, this press conference is going to be an attempt to get the Sugar and Fitzmaurice to stand up and speak in favor of the right to sleep somewhere and in some safe legal zones. But
right. But
there's also a concern for some of us that may take a month to get the law changed, even
right. If
we can do it.
Right.
What we need is an immediate establishment of an emergency camping area where people can be safe from troll busters. What do you
right. Think
of that idea?
Right, that's the most important of all as far as I'm concerned, is that they can get into a designated area, safe area. If you have to put a cop out there in that safe area, that's fine, you know, because there's always, you know, maybe one or two or three rowdies out there, you know, and they can clean that up, you know, and have a nice, peaceful, safe place to live, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the mistake was the last time in the tent city was they didn't have, you know, someone who was really an authority there, you know. I mean, there was homeless people trying to do their best to you know, but it was hard because homeless people were too directly connected with everybody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Where if it was a police officer out there, you know, just make the rounds once in a while.
You could have somebody in the middle. You could have maybe some sort of social service person who, if things got rough, could get the police quickly.
Uh-huh.
And who could be an authority in the area if necessary, too.
Yeah.
That might be a good middle ground.
Lines, yeah, and that's what we could stop the deaths, we could stop the suffering, and most prevalently is the fear that we all have to live under every day, you know, every night. They're going to either kick you out from downtown because you have no place to go, or they're going to kick you out of your tent in the woods, you know, stuff like that, and then drive you farther and farther into danger. Anyway, I know you got to get on with your subject, so I guess I better let you go.
Thank you, Dan.
Okay, we'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now we're going to rush into this tape, as I've been promising. It begins with a bit of oral communication at the 4 o'clock session of the task force to re-examine the camping ordinance last Monday. This was supposed to have been the session where Catherine Byers would finally, they would begin to have a discussion of the actual language. One of our criticisms was that, as you can read from this today's Sentinel, they're always talking about lifting the camping ordinance, but those of us who brought this issue forward didn't want to lift the camping ordinance, most of us. We wanted to repeal the sleeping ban sections of the camping ban in certain select areas of the city, like industrial zones. And here you hear this coming up, and you hear Catherine Byers finally coming down to say essentially no dice. All the conversations for the last 2 months have essentially been pointless because we're not even going to discuss language. I'm laying down the law. I've had a private conversation with Fitzmaurice and with Crone and Sugar, the other two members of the task force. This seemed to be what had happened when we came to this meeting, and there was just general outrage. We'll play as much of this as we can, and then we'll continue playing it on Thursday, though hopefully we'll have better news because there's also a city council meeting coming up on Tuesday. That's the day after tomorrow, Tuesday the 9th, and I encourage everyone to come to this press conference tomorrow at 3:45 and or 5:15 and in the task force meeting at 4, all in the same place in front of the library, and the task force meeting on the second floor of the downtown public library. And then the city council meets at 7 o'clock, and I suggest people show up in force, in mass, at that city council meeting to demand protection from the kind of troll busting that is putting innocent people into the hospital because the mayor and the new elected city council people don't have the political courage to take the action that they have been told to take by their constituents.
I would like to not comment at this time. I understood that we were not able to get to item 5, which was the drafting.
This is whatever Silva speaking.
Due to you know, all of our enthusiasm with all kinds of different aspects of this, it's been going on quite some time. I would just beg that all of us, let's hear what they have to say. Let's see what they're going to give us.
Yeah, for the record, I wanted to follow up on my promise of last meeting that I would get the hotline statistics to you in time for this meeting. And it's packaged in our annual report of direct client services.
This is Paul Grindel speaking, who is a very knowledgeable person on shelter issues.
Hotline statistics are significant, I think, because it breaks out the calls for help that come from homeless, shelterless, and at-risk people all over the county. And it'll tell you what kind of help were they asking for, what area of the county were they calling from. And the most significant thing that it points out is this god-awful increase in the number of single female-headed households that are calling. It's just overwhelmingly women are calling the hotline. And of the 1,200 children represented, all but 160 came with those calls from women. So I have a hunch that what we could do is go compare that to the hotline calls from last year and the year before that, and see if there's a trend here. This is the first time it's really jumped out at me, but that may portend what's coming.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Just a couple of things that might be helpful in this sort of examination, since you're going to be looking at actual language. Some ideas, a 24-hour limit on parking in a particular place so that folks could be moved along to other neighborhoods if there's a concern. An 8-hour grace period, such as is used with the street performers guidelines, whereas now we have an hour limit on street performers guidelines, so there can be if a person is uncomfortable with someone sleeping in front of their house but has no criminal complaint, the person in essence would be asked to move within 8 hours and find another legal place to park in their vehicle or sleep if they're on public property on the street. I brought along some zoning maps, which you probably have already seen, but they cover the different residential and zoning aspects of the city. These were important for us when we, in the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Initiative, drew up the Sleeping Ban Repeal Initiative. We removed the residential and the beachfront zones, and many of us were prepared to remove the downtown area as a permissible sleeping area. It was simply a kind of a move-along area, all the residential, beachfront, and areas. You could then tell someone who was sleeping, not we're going to give you a ticket now, but you have to move in 10 or 20 minutes. If you don't move, you'll get a ticket unless you move to a legal zone. So this might be useful for you to look at in your examining of the wording. It's the only copy I've got, but you're welcome to use it if it's helpful. Again, for a lot of us believe that while this is happening, we were concerned in the last 2 months there has been no real protection for homeless people. You perhaps saw this very dramatically when on Friday at the Homeless Community Resource Center, one man came forward beaten by youths, apparently, by his account. And when the police, by his account, declined to take a report and he complained about it, he got a ticket himself for public drunkenness. This kind of troll busting, there were also some unconfirmed reports of two or three or four more instances of this, which I can't confirm, so I don't want to necessarily stand behind them. But I think that having a suspension of the sleeping ban in at least one or two zones of the city while you're debating this is very important so that homeless people can join this debate and be safe during this period of time. And I don't think it's too much for the community to ask, and I also think it would act as a sort of a trial run. People could see what's going on, and there could be then a sunsetting clause to this, to sunset when you make your decision here or when the city council makes its decision on the larger issue. You may have seen this flyer, Ban Bigotry, Not Homeless People. It's actually not homelessness. We have three different proposals here. One of them is the minimum protection, one's more protection, one's the most protection. Concerns, for example, the Pottinger guidelines, which you can look at. They talk about you don't criminalize people if they're engaging in life-sustaining activities unless you have a shelter space for them to go to. And I know you're probably familiar with this. You've looked at those papers. I think that was our maximum proposal. Our minimum proposal was just eliminated in certain zones of the city so people can sleep at night, look for a regulated campground, eliminate the blanket ban entirely, because covering up with blankets can never be a basis for any kind of criminal prosecution in a civilized society. Require a warning for all sleeping and blanket ban tickets as is currently provided in one section 6.3, 6.0, 6.0, but not in the rest. Waive community service fees for low-income people. Provide an amnesty for all pending tickets. And I'll pass you a copy of this flyer so you can look it over. And as David said, shut up so we can get on with the real business of getting this language underway. Thank you.
I'm Heidi, and I'm with UCSC Students Against the Sleeping Ban. And the reason why we're finally getting into this is because the
university, Heidi Cunningham,
we read
Students
like,
Against the Sleeping
Ban.
Human
rights accord, and we learn about criminalization of poverty, and here it is, right where we go. So another reason why students are concerned is because we're facing homelessness as well with the huge rent problem and the expense of working full-time and making minimum wage and going to school. So that's why we're here. I'd really encourage you guys to come up to the university and talk to us like you were supposed to be a while ago. But it got canceled because I think there's a lot of things that students could say about this because we're concerned as well.
I'm Lauren Smith from the Peace and Freedom Party. And I've been
Lauren
negligent.
Smith from the Peace and Freedom Party. Opposes the sleeping ban.
Come to one of these meetings. So I'm not going to make a long statement. What I want to do is find out if we're going to hear of any research that's been done with other cities. Will that be coming up today? And if there's need for help in that area, I'd like to volunteer to help in terms of finding out Berkeley or San Luis Obispo or Santa Barbara, whatever it is. If it's a matter of staff time, I have the current luxury of just having retired and no longer going over the hill to work every day. And I think that this has got to be the project that I adopt first because it's just here. And I read the paper. I'm sorry to, you know, read some of Mike's comments and so forth. I plan to talk to Mike myself, but he is in a good position to assign students to, you know, to do some of this research also. At any rate, I'm going to shut up now myself, and I'll probably, I do have some definite ideas that I want to discuss at some point, but not today. Yes.
I came here today with the understanding that people had already come knowing that the camping ban, the sleeping ban weren't going to be changed. So just at the risk of wasting my breath,
Roxanne, the Beach Flats
community activist. The thing that concerns me the most about doing nothing is that I think that we create the troll busters, the people that go out and see these people as nothing, as people to kick. A junior high buddy of a friend of mine's son found a sleeping man adjacent to their driveway and kicked him and kicked him and kicked him when he wouldn't wake up. I think that he was probably inebriated. And then decided to stab him, went back into the house and got a steak knife. He's 14 years old. He has no remorse. When you talk to him about it, he says, well, he just shouldn't have been there. It was our property. I think that when you do nothing about this, you make these people nothing. And they aren't nothing. They're unfortunate, and many of them are children, as you've been told by the Community Action Board. And I hope that by elevating their status to that of any other human being in Santa Cruz, having rights, only being without a house, that you could change that, because this violence is getting worse and worse and worse in Santa Cruz. This is not a sweet little town. You see the people that do this, that go downtown and hassle them, the skinhead element and stuff, they're not homeless. They take a lot of room up downtown. I just house sat out on Swanton Boulevard and for 5 nights. And every night there were great, big, beautiful RVs parked across from the house. People who came to Santa Cruz and slept there. So
What we've been asking you for all along is to treat everyone equally, which isn't done. And I'm asking you to give these people the status of a human being. Right now, they have the status of dogs, that they're, or worse than dogs, that you can just get rid of them if they are bothering you. And I'm going to hold you accountable. I hold our whole city accountable for creating this kind of us and them, because people are so afraid that someone might park in front of their yard or pee on their bush. It doesn't make sense to me. What we're creating that is so violent, it doesn't make sense to me for what the fear is. You know, are you guys afraid of all UC students? They robbed a Costco. Two of them just went on a spree and robbed two stores.
Studies illegal.
Yeah, you know, I guarantee that the town as a general population is not freaked out by UC students. But for whatever reason, when a homeless person is brought up on anything, you know, it's that, oh yeah, we got to keep, they could rape women, they could do this, they could do that. So do shoe salesmen, you know. So please, give these people some dignity, and think about, I really want all of you, our parents and grandparents, I want you to think of your child or grandchild falling on hard times, being afraid to tell you, not wanting you to know they lost their job, not wanting you to know they were hungry, and trying to make it on the streets until they could get hired, and being treated the way that these people are being treated in Santa Cruz.
Thank you, Roxanne. Well, I think this issue is pretty simple.
So Steve argued, who's forming an ad hoc revolutionary socialist Green Party.
For a segment of the population is, and you know, in the fact that it's unacceptable that sleep is a crime, and it's unacceptable that covering yourself up with the blankets is a crime anywhere. And I want to remind the city council members that there are elections coming up, not immediately, but there will be, and there are other political parties besides the Democrats and Republicans, and that there are alternatives in terms of going into the streets and protesting and bringing people into Santa Cruz to protest and to make this a big focus. The violation of civil rights going on in Santa Cruz. In fact, I think that's something that could even or should even be brought into the United Nations, the fact that people aren't allowed to sleep in Santa Cruz and the violation of human rights going on here. And that there are possibilities open for lawsuits against the city of Santa Cruz. And I just wanted to point out those things.
I just wanted to bless you here for bringing up some very good points. What are we
teaching
our children?
This is Marilyn Weaver, who works at the Homeless Services Center.
By having ordinances like this, that instead of teaching our kids compassion for those who are less fortunate than we are for whatever reason, we're teaching them to be angry or discriminate. We are teaching them discrimination. And I just hope, I'll cut this real short, that when you make your decisions, that you're making them from here, your heart. That when nobody else is around and you're sitting and you're thinking and you've seen maybe someone who touched you, that you're thinking that hopefully what you did will make their life better. That the decisions come from here and not thinking of people's pocketbooks or people's discriminatory practices or whatever. That's all.
I hear from you and then I hear from you.
Observation.
being that the city of Santa Cruz is building a $13 million police complex.
This is Ray, a vehicular person who recently filed a ticket in court.
I'm sure the Santa Cruz Police Department is going to get all the bells and whistles to their new home. I think I heard banter that's about $130,000 just in the computers for the Santa Cruz Police Department. Again, $13 million is a lot of money. If the city can do that kind of effort, I guess you get a big equal effort for building a new police complex. But it sure is not going to clothe, it's not going to shelter anybody. Point to that is, if the city is willing to invest in their future, I guess, for all the way from the chief of police down to the rookie officers have the best at facilities, we're going to have it here. That's a lot of money, again, $13 million. I'm not saying you're going to invest $13 million in homelessness, but at least decriminalize homelessness in the context that it's a paradox that California is number one in prison population in the world. Just the state prisons have 200,000. I'm not a criminal, so I'm not trying to defend criminals or criminality, but most of my adult life was military, so. Anyway, point to that is we have more prisoners than North Korea, North Vietnam, Cuba. Yeah, it's a paradox. It really is a paradox. The number one growth industry in the state of California is prison population, corrections, prison personnel, and prison construction. So it's a growth industry. It's a real money maker for this state. I think we're going to spend several more billion in the foreseeable future in prison construction and prison personnel. I'm not here to, we could invest it in the future of our people in education. That's just an observation. But, it's interesting that we can do better. Thank you.
Oh, what's this?
Tape recorder.
Oh, okay.
I'm a retired design engineer, and I have a for instance of how someone can become homeless, someone who's always had a place to live all their lives and gets to be almost 60 years old and even has a daughter who's married, and she and her husband both have jobs and well able to support the mother, and the mother living in the home of the married daughter, and the husband decides that he doesn't like his mother-in-law and she can't live with them anymore, and so she has to move out, and she goes and finds a job at a gas station as a cashier, and it's not even a full-time job, and then she has to somehow find a room to stay in. She can't afford an apartment. So she finds a room and somehow manages to come up with the security deposit and the first month's rent. Then 2 days later, a customer at the gas station has trouble with the pump. She goes out to assist the woman. The woman gets very belligerent and starts moving toward the older woman, the cashier, in order to possibly attack her. The cashier backs up to avoid the woman, trips over the island where the gas pumps are, and falls and breaks her arm. So she can't work anymore at the gas station until her arm heals, if there's even a job there when she gets better. She goes on workman's compensation, which takes time to even get, and she gets maybe two-thirds of the minute amount that she's already making. And she can no longer afford the room. Even if the price of the room is reduced as low as possible. And she doesn't even have to have a security deposit. She still can't afford the room. So where is she to go? Hopefully, the daughter takes pity on her and somehow persuades her husband to let her come back home, but maybe she's going to be joining the ranks of the homeless.
Get to the land.